all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I'll be your host for today's program, and I'm really excited to be talking to you today. We've got a great program lined up. We're going to be talking about some veteran job opportunities. We're going to be talking about what's going on at the VA, and in our third half of the program, as they say, we're going to be talking with the author of a book entitled First to Jump, How the Band of Brothers Was Aided by the Brave Paratroopers of Pathfinder's Company. Jerome Pressler, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but we will talk to him in just a little while to talk about that. These are the guys that went in before the guys that went in before the guys. So I'm really excited about that, and it's a great read, and I'm anxious to talk with the author about First to Jump. A couple of announcements that we want to get out for you today. There are some events that are coming up. Number one is on November 6th or 7th. There's at the Cobo Center, there is a job fair going on there. The MichiganVeterans.com is sponsoring of that organization, or the sponsoring organization, and they're going to be doing that. So we want to make sure that you are aware of that event. If you have any events that you want us to promote here on Veterans Radio, we want you to get a hold of us. You can go to our website and click on Contact Us, send us a message of what's going on. In the next couple of weeks, of course, we're going to have a lot of announcements of events going on about Veterans Day coming up, of course, on the 11th of November. And also, right around that time, is going to be the 11th anniversary of Veterans Radio. So here's a little secret for you. We want you to participate in our anniversary program this year. It's going to be on November 9th from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And we want to know what Veterans Day means to you. So you can go to our Facebook account. That's facebook.com/veteransradio, or you can go to Twitter at Veterans Radio. Send us a short message about what Veterans Day means to you. And I want you to think about it, because it's a very, very powerful day for a lot of us, and we want to share these feelings with our listeners, civilian and military. So make sure you let us know what Veterans Day means to you. And we are waiting for our guest. Have I got my first guest on the line? I do. I have Matt. Right? I'm not going to have you. Hello, Matt.
Hey, how are you doing, Dale?
I'm doing terrific. Thank you very much for agreeing to be on the program today. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, we were talking about jobs for veterans, and this is something right up your alley. So tell us about VetBiz.
Well, VetBiz Central is a veteran business outreach center. We're funded by the U.S. Small Business Administration, and we assist the veterans in trying to start and establish businesses. And our premier event is coming up, our 9th annual Veteran Business Conference. It's going to be over in Grand Rapids this year at the Crown Plaza Hotel at 5700 East 28th Street in Grand Rapids. And it's a Veteran Business Conference to help the established veteran business owners connect with corporate America that's looking to engage with them and engage through supplier diversity channels and supply chains and vendor channels to help the small veteran business community excel.
Well, I'm looking at, if people go to your website, which is vetbizcentral.org, you've got a lot of great information right there on the front page. It's called, you know, Veterans Helping Veterans. And that you've got entrepreneurial training and counseling, networking opportunities, mentoring programs, advocacy services, procurement counseling, because for those of you out there that are not aware of it, if you are a veteran-owned business, especially if you're a service-connected veteran-owned business, you get some priority. Isn't that true with government contracts?
Yeah, that's right, Dale. 3% on the federal side, and in fact, the state of Michigan has a 5% goal for reaching out to the service-disabled veteran-owned business community. So if you're a service-disabled veteran-owned business and looking to procure a contract with the state of Michigan, they do have goals for that. They're, you know, extensively looking to reach out to you and identify you through their supply chains and vendor program portals. It's a great way to get engaged with the community as a whole, as a veteran business. So, again, people don't understand that right now there's a lot of VBE programs, such as Women Business Enterprises, Minority Business Enterprises, And now included in that is the veteran business community. Whether you're a veteran-owned or a service-disabled veteran-owned business, corporate America, as well as the federal government, and indeed the state government, is looking to do business with you. So if you happen to fall in that niche of the veteran business community, I would encourage you to reach out to our organization. We're federally funded by the U.S. Small Business Administration. I'm located in Flint, Michigan, and I cover a 6-state region, which includes Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. So we're here in your backyard. We're helping the veteran business community engage, and it's our premier event. And, again, GM, Ford, Kellogg, Delphi, SpartanNash, AT&T, Magna, Takata, Herman Miller, just a variety of companies out there looking to engage with the veteran business community. So I would encourage everybody to visit our website, veteranscentral.org. Get some information if you're a veteran business owner, and certainly attend our premier event.
Well, it sounds really exciting. I got one more thing I wanted to ask you about. On your webpage, you've got a story about help fellow veteran business owners turn a $10 donation into $50,000. How does that one work?
Well, Dale, that's a great story. And Keith King, the president of the National Veteran Business Development Council, is going to be doing a general session at our conference. And this is anyone in the veteran business world knows about the verification program that exists in the federal government,
mm-hmm.
which is ran by the Central, or CVE, rather, under the VA's umbrella. Well, Keith King has now formed a nonprofit organization that received sponsorship and commitment from Kellogg, GM, Ford, AT&T, and Chrysler to do a third-party veteran business verification. And this is really critical for our veteran business community out there, because it gives the veteran business community an opportunity to have their business verified, which is then recognized by corporate America. And this is an area that's it's really growing and trending. And Keith King and I are close friends, and I've been a big supporter of this movement from the onset. And he's done a great thing to get this off the ground and launched, and money behind it. So for the veteran business community, it's just a fantastic thing to be in an opportunity to have your business verified as an actual veteran-owned mm-hmm. or service-disabled veteran-owned small business.
I think it's great, and I encourage all of you out there, all you veterans out there that are thinking about starting a business, or you've already got a small one going and you need some help getting to the next level, go to vetbizcentral.org and register for their upcoming program in Grand Rapids on the
29th of October.
29th of October, 0800 1600 hours, Grand Rapids, Michigan, 9th Annual Veteran Business Conference Meet and Greet. And you can find out more information on their website. This is going to be at the Crown Plaza in Grand Rapids. I wish we could get up there. I'm hoping we can. Thank you, Matt, so very much for being on Veterans Radio, and we'll hopefully get to talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dale. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you very much. Well, in the continuing saga of jobs for veterans, our next guest here on Veterans Radio is Dr. Joseph Harrison, Jr., who currently serves as the Chief Civilian Human and Resources Division Recruitment and Retention Branch of the United States Army Medical Command. Captain Harrison, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, Dale, you had me laughing there. That was a mouthful. Thank you for having me.
It is our pleasure to have you on. And I guess the first thing we need to do is explain what all that was. What is MedCom?
Well, MedCom is nothing more, and I know your veteran friends will definitely understand the military and their acronyms. It's an acronym for the United States Army Medicine, which is, again, and part of the medicine portion of it, MedCom, is the medical command. So it's the United States Army Medical Command, which is a part of Army Medicine.
Okay. And they are looking to do some recruiting, correct?
Oh, yes, sir. I mean, we're always recruiting. Everyone knows about the military side. I mean, you can walk down the street and you run in recruiters' offices from the smallest to the largest cities. However, one thing that a lot of people don't know, and I think your audience can relate to this also, ever since we got rid of the draft in 1973, the demographic of people who serve in the military really shrunk. Recent studies, have said it's only about 1% of the population actually serves in the military.
Right.
So consequently, a lot of people have no idea that you can actually work for the Army and not be in the Army. And so that's what we are. We're the Civilian Corps of the United States Army Medical Command. Now, another interesting tidbit is that civilians make up approximately 60% of the Army Medical Command. And so consequently,
wow,
that means there's a lot of jobs and opportunities out there for people.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, what I was saying is that, and us, as far as the recruitment goes, we're really trying to recruit, as they say, the hard-to-fill positions. You know, those are the clinical people, the people that actually touch someone, if you will. You know, that doctor, that nurse. Since I've been doing this for a while, you know, I find sometimes behavioral health people, they don't like to say they're medical, they're behavioral health. So
mm-hmm.
I'm going to, you know, say go along with them. I think they're medical, but if they want to say that, that's okay. We just want to get them. So we want behavioral health people, which can be social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, nurse practitioners, technicians. Again, the medical people we want, the physicians, the nurses, the technicians, the people who are actually touching someone. And then another part that I think will be near and dear to a lot of your listeners is that we also are trying to get people hired with targeted disabilities.
Okay.
Now, what is a targeted disability? Well, a general definition would be, say, mental retardation or people with severe physical or psychiatric disability. However, we don't make that determination, Dale.
Mm-hmm.
There's something called Schedule A Hiring Authority. Now, it's not just for the medical command. Okay, it's for the federal government, but we're using it for us. And I'm going to encourage people to go to civilianmedicaljobs.com. I'm going to say that one more time.
Okay.
Civilianmedicaljobs.com. That's our website. And through that website, they can find different jobs, different benefits, the locations. I think we're always trying to improve the website, and we'll look forward to people's, feedback to us to see how we can improve it. But back to the people with the disabilities, you know, this is Disability Employment Awareness Month also. And so we want to make sure that people are aware of the fact that the United States Army Medical Command, we are actually proactively going out trying to find people with targeted disabilities using that Schedule A letter
mm-hmm.
that so we can get them employed. Because a lot of times, all people really need is a reasonable accommodation, and if they can get a reasonable accommodation, they can work.
Right.
You know, you think about it, Dale. I don't know what happens. You know, people think like disability is catching or something. If you notice if you go to a waiting room or something, and someone may be in a wheelchair or they may have a burn or whatever it may be. I mean, people, like, sit across the room from them, and it's like, hey, what do you do? I mean, they're people just like us, and so and they want to provide for their families just like we do. And so I think I think the United States Army Medical Command is doing an outstanding job in reaching out to people and trying to, if you will, overcome that stigma and get them employed.
Well, I know we've talked to a lot of Army and Marine and Navy medics on this program over the last 10 years or so, and they're always looking for work when they get done, because they say we just can't kind of fit into the civilian thing, and so maybe they should be going to civilianmedicaljobs.com and seeing what they can find there.
Yes, sir, and I'm going to encourage them to go, because and one thing I want to say about, especially with the disability hiring portion, you know, it's not a training. You know, the people have to have the requisite skills,
mm-hmm.
but using sort of a vernacular to say, if you get the Schedule A letter, which you can get from a licensed physician, a state vocational rehab counselor, a VA counselor, anyone that has an authorization to provide, if you will, disability benefits, so it's the Social Security Administration,
mm-hmm.
they can provide the letter. We have an example of that letter on our website. Again, it's civilianmedicaljobs.com. But they can go, and if their questions aren't answered, we have a section on that website that says contact us. And I guarantee you, it's not the black hole that some people are used to.
Right.
If someone writes to us with a question, and we don't care, there is no such thing as a dumb question. We will answer it to you. I mean, our goal is to get people answered within 24 hours, and sometimes we even do it quicker than that.
Okay. Well, we'll be. I know your phone number, so if you don't respond, I'll be calling you myself. Dr. Joseph Harrison, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. I encourage our audience out there, civilian and or military, to go to civilianmedicaljobs.com. Maybe there's a future there for you.
I think so. Thank you very much, Dale.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we'll be right back after this message. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back, boom, here on Veterans Radio. And so I've got two places for you to go if you're looking for a job out there. One is vetbizcentral.org. Check them out and go to civilianmedicaljobs.com. And right now, joining me on the radio is our new friend, Raymond Kelly. Ray Kelly is with the VFW. And Ray, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dale.
Thank you very much for agreeing to be on.
Absolutely.
I called you because I want to know what's going on at the VA, and I thought maybe you might know.
You know what? There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of misinformation, so I'm glad you got a hold of me. Hopefully, we'll be able to clear a few things up.
Okay, we got about 10 minutes, so tell me what
okay.
you know.
All right, so I think everybody knows that a new law was passed, just for ease of term, we'll call it the Veterans Choice Program,
okay,
which will allow veterans to receive easier access to care outside of VA if under certain circumstances. Two of those circumstances are if you wait right now over 30 days to receive your appointment, you can invoke that access, and VA will work to schedule you an appointment outside of VA. Also, if you live over 40 miles away from VA, you can you also automatically qualify for non-VA care. So VA will coordinate that care. You can go in your community for doctor's appointments.
So
that's
can
a good thing. You know, get veterans off a waiting list, mm-hmm. get veterans seeing physicians closer to home, and the care will still be coordinated through VA, so all needs will be taken care of.
That's cool. So that means that if I live over 40 miles away from a VA center, I can use my private doctor.
So
as long as it's approved.
So right? there's a little some complexities to it. So
yeah.
It starts
always,
in November.
There always are.
Like November 6th. Is when the program will start.
Mm-hmm.
The complexity to it is you have to call and make an appointment or call VA. And if you live more than 40 miles away, they'll do the authorization, but they'll okay. probably go through a series of things. So they have, contracts with doctors because they want to make sure they're quality doctors, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if your doctor is in that network, yes, you would be able to use that doctor. If not,
okay.
they will probably give you a choice of several doctors in your area that would be able to provide that service for you.
Well, this is a very big deal, Ray, to be able to have a little bit more, a few more options available instead of at some of the VA hospitals where people were waiting, extended periods of time.
Yeah, it was completely unacceptable. VA had the authority to do it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But because of budget constraints and doctor or the hospital networks trying to figure out how are we going to see the patients that come here and pay for it and pay the money that it costs, because it is much more expensive to purchase that care outside of VA. How do we do both? And, mm-hmm. and they were failing. So this law, provides them about $17 billion over the next, up to 3 years to be able to provide that care, through other means a little easier and a little quicker. And it's going to be complex. There'll probably be some hiccups in the first few months of it, like any other new program, of making sure that doctors are in the network, that medical records are getting back to VA so they know if there's any follow-ups that need to happen, who they would need to schedule that through. So.
Okay, well, that's the first big thing that everybody was all concerned about was, actually getting in and seeing a doctor if you have a problem. So,
right.
What's next on the agenda, or what's the next thing they do?
It's still within that. they're still trying to figure out how any co-payments will be paid. So right now we're under the belief, they're still working through everything, we're under the belief that if it's a service-connected condition, you will not pay anything at any point. If it is a non-service-connected, they're trying to determine when you'll pay your co-payment. And so they're trying to get it to where the private doctor will bill VA even for that co-payment, and then VA will bill the patient later, so the veteran won't have to pay anything up front when they go see a doctor out of town.
That's it. This is sounding even better.
Yeah, so when everything works out right, that's what we're hoping for. And any follow-on appointments would be coordinated through VA. So let's say you went in, you had a dermatology appointment, and they said, or you had a primary care appointment, and they said, you got a couple moles that we need to have taken a look at. Then VA would coordinate to have a dermatologist look at that. If they had the room within VA, if you lived within that 40 miles, they would take care of you. If not, they would go ahead and schedule that for you out in the private sector as well.
Oh, okay. That's terrific stuff, Ray. That is really cool.
So the other things on the docket, it looks like COLA we will get a COLA in December.
Yay.
they haven't determined the amount yet. Probably 1.5, 1.8, I think, is where it's floating right now. But they're going to wait until November to be able to determine what that is
Remind our audience out there. That's just a cost of living increase to whatever your benefits might be. Normally that COLA increase is tied to whatever Social Security gets also.
So absolutely.
For all of us out there beyond 65, if we're getting Social Security, we might be getting a little bump in that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. They look like there will be an increase for both, and VA's increase is based off of what Social Security's increase is.
Okay, so we're looking at COLA. What else is going on at the VA?
So
it's a lot.
Obviously, disability claims, they're moving in the right direction. They are getting a computer system that is much more comprehensive and easier for their claims processors to use. In the past, there were over 21 places where somebody's personal information would be put in, like a mailing address. Right. They've got that down to 3.
Okay.
And before, they would have to go in and manually enter that into each spot. So that's not a very efficient system when you're trying to process more claims. So they're to the point where they've got it down to 3. They've got electronic systems, so there are claims being done now completely electronically. You fill it out online. It's sent to VA online. They look at it online. Only thing that might not be are medical records that are dated prior to the system being in the system, but then they scan those so they can look at those as well. So
that's another big
getting
step
to the point where they can speed things up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are talking with Ray Telly with the VFW about what's going on at the VA. And is there anything else that we need to know? We got about 2 minutes left, 3 minutes left.
So for retirees, we got to have our focus come February. The Military Retirement Commission is going to come out with their recommendations on what the future of military retirement and military benefits looks like. So be looking for that come beginning of February is when they suspect they're going to put that out. VFW will be in the mix of that, making sure that our retirees and our service members don't get the short end of the stick.
Right, and I encourage all of our listeners out there to go ask your congressional candidates that are running in 2 weeks, what do they feel about supporting veterans? You know, let's see if you put them in get them into a corner and make them, you know, make some decisions here instead of doing one of their little lame duck things that seem to occur between November and January. So we want to make sure that. And I also urge all of you to support your local veterans organizations, whether it's the VFW, American Legion, Vietnam Veterans, AMVETS, all of them are out there working for you. And
yes,
so
they are.
If you know somebody in these organizations or you want to get involved, check them out. They're really a bunch of good guys and ladies nowadays.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's right. I have to forget before I get slapped again. We got 2 minutes left. So What else do we need to know, Ray, about what's coming up?
So the big dangerous thing that's lurking right now is sequestration. Everybody's talking about it. That's just a fancy word for giving 10% of the government's money back to itself. But what's harmful in that is DOD takes 50% of it, but they're only 20-some percent of the whole budget. And if that stays enacted through 2016, with all the operations that we have moving forward, will be detrimental to our ability, not just to pay for what we're doing, but just the training, our readiness, our responsiveness. I had a briefing from the general of NATO a couple weeks ago, and he said, if it stays in place, we won't be able to finish the mission.
Right.
So we need that when your listeners are talking to their members of Congress, we need to pin them on what are they going to do to end sequestration as well.
Absolutely, Ray. I want to remind people out there, if you do have any issues with the VA or anything like that, contact people like the VFW or the VSO for the VFW. They can help you with that claim system and get you through the system. So, Ray, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. I'm looking forward to having you on again in the near future.
Absolutely, Dale, anytime.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right,
we're going to take a quick break for the news here in just a second. We've got about 30 seconds, so I'm just going to do a little fill, and then you're going to get to listen to some lovely music. But we're going to be right back after the news with First to Jump, how a band of brothers was aided by the brave paratroopers of Pathfinder's Company. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back after this break.
Is the Blaze Radio News. I'm Dave Perkins.
My background is psychology, and I know what creates panic.
Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Tim Murphy saying what a lot of people are thinking.
And what creates panic is when people are given information that proves to be false. So we need to stop these over-certainties from these medical folks. And I'm not sure that a czar that has no background can help that.
Murphy on Fox News Sunday adding to the chorus of voices unimpressed with the selection of Ron Klain, a man with no medical experience, a political spin master, as Ebola czar.
It's not a quarantine.
Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins talking about the list of contacts of patient zero.
But they'll be free to go. It's a protective order, and it will expire for them at midnight tonight, and that's going to be a good thing for those families who've been through so much.
The judge appearing on ABC's This Week explaining the unwinding of the timeline for release of the people on that list from what amounts to self-quarantine. The Anything But Magic Carnival Cruise coming to an end. The Blaze Radio's Chris Vermillion.
The Carnival Magic cruise ship, carrying the Dallas nurse being monitored for signs of Ebola, has now docked in Galveston, Texas. This nurse handling a lab specimen while treating Thomas Duncan, who dies of Ebola in a Texas hospital. The Coast Guard taking a blood sample, sending it to Austin, Texas for evaluation, while the nurse remains isolated aboard the ship, showing no signs or symptoms of Ebola.
A search team from the Chesterfield County Sheriff's Department was searching an abandoned property along Old Lynchburg Road in southern Albemarle County.
And finding what they hoped they wouldn't.
When they discovered what appears to be human remains.
Charlottesville, Virginia Police Chief Timothy Longo, not yet able to positively identify the remains as those of Hannah Graham, but the search for Graham now called off. The parents of Hannah Graham called in after the body found. I'm Dave Perkins. This is news on the Blaze Radio Network.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I made in American House.
Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Walter Ehlers and his brother were in the first wave to hit Omaha Beach on D-Day. Details after this. Staff Sergeant Ehlers' brother was several hundred yards away on the beach, and they didn't see each other. Ehlers' unit ran into a decimated unit of Bangalore torpedo men and provided cover for them as they used their explosives to blow a hole in the German fortifications. This allowed an American breakup. On June 9th, Ehlers' platoon came under heavy fire. He climbed a hedgerow and called his men to follow. He spotted a German patrol and killed four of the enemy. Ordering his men to fix bayonets and firing from his hip, he destroyed a machine gun nest. He then attacked a second machine gun, killing three more. The platoon moved out the next morning and came under intense fire from both sides. The commander ordered a withdrawal. Ehlers realized that someone had to provide cover. He motioned his automatic rifleman to follow him, scrambled to the top of a mound of earth that provided a vantage point. They began firing on the Germans, drawing fire away from the rest of the platoon. Ehlers was hit in the back, but was able to kill the sniper that shot him. When his rifleman was wounded, Ehlers dragged him to safety. Ehlers was treated at a field station and insisted on returning to action. Unable to strap on a backpack, he strapped on two bandoliers of ammunition, picked up a rifle, and went to find his men. A month later, he was informed that his brother was killed on Omaha Beach. Ehlers was presented the Medal of Honor by Lieutenant General John Lee on December 19, 1944.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Schoolcraft College is proud to have served the communities of Southeast Michigan for five decades. So it should come as no surprise that they're just as committed to serving those who have served our country. Schoolcraft College Veteran Services provides assistance to veterans using their educational benefits. They help with the VA benefits application process, provide academic advising, and plan programs of study according to VA guidelines. Classes are forming now in Livonia and Garden City. Visit schoolcraft.edu for more information.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be joined by our guest in just a second, Jerome Preisler, who's written a book called First to Jump, How the Band of Brothers was Aided by the Brave Paratroopers of Pathfinder's Company. I just want to read a paragraph to you from the foreword, because as soon as I read this, I had to read the whole thing. So, they were considered mavericks, insubordinates, and undesirables, and they did plenty to earn the reputation. Their commanding officers were glad, not to say overjoyed, to see them ship out to train for their special missions, glad just to be rid of them. Never mind that those missions were thought to be suicidal. They were the United States Army Pathfinders of the 9th Troop Carrier Command, the first paratroopers to jump into combat, and they were heroes to a man. I'd like to welcome the author, Jerome Preisler. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Dale.
Hi,
thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much for agreeing to be on the program. This is kind of a short notice thing, so I thank you very much. This book, obviously, we're going to kind of do a pre-sell promo of this thing because it isn't released until later on. But I just want to talk about this. This was fascinating to me to read about these men. You know, we've all heard and so forth, and these were the guys who went in before them.
Yeah, I was rather surprised when I was looking for. I had done another World War II narrative nonfiction called Codename Caesar for the same publisher and editor, and was looking for a follow-up, and I was looking to do something that an untold story. And I had heard about the Pathfinders and read about them in a few books, but not extensively. And I was really surprised to find out that no one had actually done any sort of book or any sort of lengthy article, really, even about these men.
I think with all of these guys seem to be pretty much undesirables in the companies and places that they were, and you know they were recruited almost for being insubordinate.
Right, and what had happened was they really did feel the brass really did feel that there was an 80% mortality rate, casualty rate, I should say. They thought these guys were going to die, and in fact, by all common sense, you would think they would. Their mission was to land in advance of the rest of the airborne troops. So they were, in effect, the vanguard of the vanguard, and they were jumping behind enemy lines with no support, just their light, their guns on them, not even any rations, it was, although the Pathfinders was a volunteer program, a lot of the men were strongly encouraged to volunteer by their commanding officers, and in many instances it was implied or even stated overtly that they could spend time in a brig for insubordination. Some of these guys had gone, were all of these soldiers were really able men. Mm-hmm. A lot of them just had problems with discipline, and that is to say, when they were off in England, they would hit the bars. They would go AWOL for some time, and they were and in a sense, I think they were guys who needed motivation. They were and they proved themselves to be among the most courageous of all soldiers of World War II.
As I've said, you know. And I'll say many times during the interview, it's just a fascinating story about these ne'er-do-wells who are, you know, as you say, are courageous. They're obviously smart. They know how to think in three dimensions, it seemed like, and they always ended up, you know, having a plan B or C that they could go to. Where did the Pathfinders begin? Was this a result of some other problem in World War II?
Mm-hmm. Going back to July 1943, the first major American paratroop jump of the war was Operation Husky, the invasion of Sicily, and in effect, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. The planes coming in with the paratroopers hit 50 mile an hour winds. They were coming in at night, and a lot of the transport pilots had not had sufficient training in night formation flying. Compounding all of that, there were some communication breakdowns, and the anti-aircraft batteries, the Allied anti-aircraft batteries in the Mediterranean, were largely unaware that the planes would be coming overhead. As a result, the two parachute infantry regiments that were involved were the 504th and the 505th. The 504th commanded by Tucker, the 505th by Gavin. The 504th, which I believe had 1,600 men, of those 1,600, only 400 actually reached their rally points, and they were decimated. Planes were shot down. They were really hit hard. The 505th wasn't hit as hard, but again, missed all their rally points, and they ended up really contributing to Sicily because then Colonel Slim Jim Gavin just started wandering around trying to orient himself toward the beaches, picking up scattered paratroopers, and they ended up involved in a lot of key skirmishes. After that, though, they knew they needed a better way, so Gavin, who was one of the two men who really helped organize our airborne forces,
right.
Gavin and General William C. Lee, knew they needed, Gavin in particular, knew he needed something that could prevent this from happening again. So he met with a number of his aides and advisors. He also called in some British officers and, very, very importantly, brought in Lieutenant Joel Crouch, who was innovative flyer, one of the great airmen of World War II, and really in our military history. And these guys together, most specifically Gavin and Crouch, got together and worked out this whole Pathfinder idea. And it was very simple. The idea was they send in, as mentioned earlier, they send in troops, a small number of men ahead of the airborne waves, they would be equipped with what was then cutting-edge technology, or at least a new application of technology. The two things that they used were light panels that were called halophane lights, and these were colored panels that would signal, would be visual aid signals. And then they had a unit that was called the Eureka, which would communicate with a unit aboard the transports that was called the Rebecca. And that would allow, these were beacons that would allow the C-47 transports bearing the main wave of paratroopers to come in and drop their men more precisely at the drop zones.
Well, this whole thing, we're talking with Jerome Preisler, who's the author of First to Jump. I should point out to our audience that you are an author of many other books and that you worked with Tom Clancy on many of his books. And you have a whole series on CSI and so forth. I was really shocked to realize how many books I'd read that were, you know, that you had written or had helped write. So I'm glad to finally get to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Try to stay busy.
I can relate to that. I can relate to this book, especially some of these guys going in there, the pilots. These Pathfinders really were designed to, you know, go in before the invasion of D-Day. And I'd never realized this. You mentioned earlier about night flying formations. I flew helicopters, which was totally different, except at night it still scared you to death, you know, getting close to somebody else, especially when clouds would suddenly jump up in front of you. But these guys that were flying around in their C-47s at 500 feet, they would come over the coast of France, you know, make a 90-degree turn and then another 90-degree turn and try and find these landings or drop zones that the Pathfinders had set up. Could you kind of talk a little bit about some of the problems that the Pathfinders had in finding their drop zones?
I really wanted to stress in the book the heroism of the C-47 pilots. These guys were flying unarmed planes, light planes that were extremely vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire. And, in fact, as they were coming in over the coast of Norway,
Normandy.
Normandy, I'm sorry.
That's a place, that's it.
that's another place. They encountered all kinds of anti-aircraft fire coming in under heavy flak. As you say, they were coming in at 500 feet. Some of them came down as low as 250 feet. They also, on the approach to Normandy, hit a massive cloud bank that went up hundreds of feet in the air. And because they had to maintain radio silence, they couldn't communicate. So Lieutenant Crouch, who was in the lead plane, had to make a decision. Was he going to go in over the clouds or under the clouds? And he determined he was going to go in under, but he couldn't tell the pilots in formation behind him he was going to do that. So he could only hope they could see his wing lights. And as things developed, some of them could, some of them couldn't. Some of them opted to go in over the clouds, some of them opted to go in under the clouds. Some went through the clouds.
You never know what's on the other side of those clouds.
they didn't know what was on the other side of them. And so it was rather chaotic. They were able to find, to make out the halophane lights. They were able to see the panels, which were arranged in a T. And the long leg of the T would be the equivalent, say, of a landing strip. So they would orient themselves along the line of that leg and then drop the paratroopers at the crossbar of the T. And, however, not all of them were at the right T. So what happened was, because of the circumstances I just described, so although the troopers did land at drop zones, they weren't necessarily the right drop zones.
Right.
And ironically, that really confused the Germans. And that confusion helped the airborne operation in the end. So what can you say? Sometimes things work out.
I really don't want to give away much of the story, so that's why I'm not getting into the individual characters. I want to people, you can go and pre-order it First to Jump on Amazon. Just look it up there. The book is going to be released in December 2nd, 2014, just in time for Christmas. There are still some paratroopers out there from the 101st Airborne. I know that. You concentrate mostly on them, but the 82nd Airborne was also involved on D-Day. But can you describe what the ground was like? When you were talking about where these paratroopers were landing, you mentioned some of the obstacles that the Germans had put down there to prevent this type of invasion.
Yeah, they were jumping into hell. Where do I begin to list it? First of all, the Germans had opened up the canals. So in order to flood what was farmland, essentially floodplain, so the farmers had irrigated this land with ditches that were 6-9 feet deep in places, and once flooded, these were traps. These were traps into which our men would sink. In some places the plain was flooded 6 feet deep. Other places not quite as deep, but they were landing in this bog. Moreover, there were wooden poles that were dubbed Rommel's asparagus because they looked like asparagus. They were in many cases ringed with barbed wire, and they were really set up as obstacles for the gliders. Rommel had not anticipated that the invasion would occur at Normandy. However, he did think there would be a smaller airborne operations, and so he had set up these traps. And the men were jumping into fields of these vertical wooden poles that were sharpened and again ringed with barbed wire. They were jumping into pitch darkness. In one particular drop zone, the Germans were waiting near a farmhouse that they had doused in gasoline and lighted on fire with torches, so that as the paratroopers came down, they were jumping into an inferno. And this particular field was ringed by German defenders who, in addition, as the men came down, shot flare guns off at them. So they were they had flares whizzing over their heads as they came down.
Right, and just imagine what that does to your night vision.
Oh, exactly. They couldn't see anything.
And you know, and you're still trying to do that. We've got about 10 minutes to go, Jerome, and I wanted to talk about just a couple of characters in the book, again, without giving the whole thing away. I encourage our listeners to go out and get a hold of this, First to Jump, by Jerome Preissler. You can find it on Amazon. It's also available. It's going to be on Kindle, and it's going to be an audio CD. I don't know. I might like to listen to the audio CD. That might be kind of exciting, too. But two people, I guess, we have time to talk about. One is Harrison Summers. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
Harrison Summers was a paratrooper who found himself leading a small group of men into a German artillery barracks that was codenamed WXYZ by our leaders. There was an artillery battery there that had actually been disabled by some of the bombings prior to the Normandy invasion. The American forces did not know that until they actually got there. But there were several hundred German soldiers billeted in the area, and Summers had marched his way kind of through happenstance to WXYZ. He was looking for his unit command and ended up leading a small group of men to clean out these barracks, which were converted farmhouses, manors. I forget exactly how many buildings there were, but there were quite a few of them. And he approached these buildings and, in essence, went a little crazy, but almost single-handedly took on these hundreds of German soldiers and went from building to building just cleaning out these buildings. And it was a bloodletting, to be clear. And he had never, this was a quiet, peaceful man in a civilian life who'd never been involved in combat of this nature before. But some of the guys he was with hesitated, and he felt, I have to do this.
Right, and because he had picked these guys up kind of along the way, and he had to show them that he could lead them. And the only way he could lead them was by example. And so he takes off. It's funny, but it's really kind of sad that he burst into a mess hall, and the Germans were just sitting there eating their meals. It's like they forgot there was a war going on.
And I still can't, I actually was thinking the other day, I was trying to figure out what they were all doing there. The battery was long, had been blown up at least a week before that. There was nothing there. But here they were, and as you say, here they were eating their meal, again as if nothing was going on.
And he took them all out, which
he
is
took them all out.
Just amazing. The other person I wanted to talk about, and this is a little bit scary, but I had a similar incident, and I might relate if we have time. Can you tell me about Ed Frosty Peters?
That was a really interesting story. I have to. We have to, of course, talk about. Man's name was Dixon.
Right,
Who was his buddy? Who was with Headquarters Intelligence, and he had actually piggybacked a ride aboard the first plane of Pathfinders. He himself, along with the two men he was with, were not Pathfinders, and it was their job, in fact, to scout out the particular German artillery battery that we were just discussing,
mm-hmm.
along with the barracks we were discussing. And they got lost and didn't quite make it. They hooked up with some guys from the 82nd, saw combat in various places, but they never made it to their objective until it was a couple of days later. So Dixon gets to the regimental command and walks over to the devastated German artillery emplacement. And as I said, there's nothing there. Everything's blown up.
Right.
And he's just taking a few moments to reflect after these nights of wandering around Normandy. And one of his buddies from college, they had both attended the University of Maryland ROTC, was Frosty Peters. Frosty Peters had another assignment. They hadn't seen each other, and out of nowhere comes walking over to him, and they just start talking. And Dixon was completely shocked to see this man there. They embrace. They give each other these big bear hugs, and they talk about some of the guys that they'd gone to school with, and trying to catch up on where they'd been stationed, whether they were still in civilian life, et cetera, et cetera. They have this conversation, and Peter says to Dixon, "Well, I guess I better be returning to my headquarters." And Dixon says, "Well, where is it?" And he goes, "Oh, just beyond those trees over there." And they say goodbye, and he just starts walking off. Dixon does not find out until about a month later that Frosty Peters had died in action several days before he saw him on that day. It gives me chills to say it, and the thing I want to emphasize here is that Dixon was a real pragmatic guy. He was not prone to flights of fancy. In recounting this story years and years later, he would say, "Listen, I hugged the man. He was there."
He was very emphatic in your book about, that he had hugged this man.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, whew.
Yeah, it gives me chills as I talk.
I know, it gives me chills. And I encourage people, there are stories like this throughout this story. We didn't even get off of Normandy yet. We still got...
No, that stone was just...
I know. We're going to have you back on, I promise. Jerome, that we'll have you back on to talk more about this because there are characters in here. There's Jake McNeese,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to talk about Jake.
We'll talk about Jake. Well, we have about 2 minutes. If you can talk about Jake in a minute, I'll let you talk about him.
Oh, boy. Jake McNeese, I'll just say this quickly. If anybody remembers the movie The Dirty Dozen, it was literally based upon a group of demolition experts called the Filthy 13, led by Jake McNeese, who was the biggest maverick you could imagine in the U.S. Army. And he... In 2 minutes, I don't know what to say except that he ended up leading after a very checkered history in the Army. He led a group of men, a small group of men, 24 guys, into Bastogne and in an operation that really, really saved our troops, the 101st Airborne, and really might have changed, well, not might have, changed the course of the war. That's all I can say.
Well, yeah, and we have to end on that. But Jerome Preisler, I thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. The book is First to Jump. Be the first to buy this, folks. Go to Amazon.com, find the book, and buy it, please. And Jerome, we'll have you back on closer to the actual publication date so we can talk more about some of these characters because they are just fascinating in there.
I look forward to it. Thanks a lot, Gil.
Thank you, Jerome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, First to Jump. So make sure you go to our website, pay attention, go to Facebook, all the other places that you want to find us. We're on Twitter, we're on Rally Point now, we're on LinkedIn, and you can comment us. Remember, I want your stories about what Veterans Day means to you. So until next week, when Bob Gould returns with his stories on Veterans Radio, my name is Dale Thronberry, and you are dismissed.